Thanks for clicking play on the Eastlake Tri-Cities Talks podcast. If you're new to this, we're trying to be the best church option for people in the Tri-Cities who aren't typically into church. We hope today's talk inspires you to take next steps in doing life in the way Jesus modeled and taught. If you're ever interested in being a part of one of our in-person gatherings, they take place every Sunday at the Uptown Theater in Richland. Check the website for current times. And regardless of what you look like, who you voted for, or where your tattoos are, we'd love to have you. But for now, here's our most recent talk. Well, good morning. Welcome to Eastlake, and welcome back to those of you who perhaps checked it out for the first time on Easter and weren't turned off enough to not come back a second time. We're glad that you're here as well. Those of you watching online, doing whatever, we're glad you're doing that too. It's always an interesting conundrum for pastors to be like, what are you going to talk about the week after Easter? Because everybody shows up on Easter, you know what they're going to talk about. And then after that, people are like, you know, what's the, you say your church people don't typically like church. What do you have for me? Like, how do I find a topic that's relevant enough that everybody can buy into and feel like there's something here that I could probably listen to and move forward for? And how does kind of Jesus' way of doing life help us with this? And so I want to do a series on hurt because who doesn't have hurt in their life? You know what I mean? It's only going to be a two-part series, not because I think there's a lack of material for all of you. It's just a matter of, this could be a two-month-long series. It could go on for months or whatever. But I just feel like it's a good buy-in one. It's a good one of saying, yeah, there's some things that I probably haven't dealt with. And in general, in a setting like this, and the kind of the format that we do with one person up here and lots of people, diverse, you know, backgrounds represented, diverse hurt backgrounds and hurt spectrums represented, you could understand how I probably won't get too specific in your area. We'll reserve that for counseling. This does not replace counseling. But I do want to take a more broad approach to it that might be a tool for your toolkit in dealing with hurt in your life, assuming that you have something to be like, there's something there to kind of work on, as I bet there probably is. And what I want to do specifically is talk about dealing with difficult people and in its relation to, because a lot of our hurt, we can be hurt in general, but like when it comes to people, that one just hurts a lot more. And by difficult people, you could also equate in there mean people if you want, right? Because people can be mean, right? You learn this, your mom tried to teach you this in middle school. Kids are just mean. They remind you, you know, she has to remind you of this and remind my wife right now. We have kids in all ages of, like, we have a high schooler and grade school and almost middle school next year. And she just goes, she like sub teaches too. So she goes and she gets to see all your kids, and it's not your kids, it's the other kids, but they're like, she's like, kids are so mean these days. They're just mean, right? And so anyways, dealing with mean people, I'm assuming that you have some sort of a background in that. So I'm trying to find some common ground. I think I'm there. You either work with mean people, you live next to mean people, you're dating or married to mean people, and that's another series we'll get back to someday. But like, mean people exist, and your interactions with them are somewhat unavoidable. And so another thing in your toolkit to kind of help you deal with mean people in this way. And the first sort of thing that I want to lay out some like basic principles. These would be things probably that even if you're like not really religious, you don't have to believe in Jesus to believe the next few things that I'm going to talk about, right? So I'm going to give you these. These would be probably something that if you went to if you went to Barnes & Noble, went in the self-help section and said, I need to deal with difficult people, there would probably be some points that are along this. And so it probably doesn't feel like we're crossing any new material when it comes to these first few points, but a good kind of like, all right, center my mind around this topic. And if I'm still kind of figuring out where this place is in terms of priority for me or influence in my life, this might help do some of that work for us. But if we're not careful, the mean people in our lives gain a measure of control over our lives. And you know this because you felt this, because when you've experienced meanness in someone else, and you have people in your life who love you and they go, don't listen to them, like, shake it off. Don't think about it. Who cares what they think of you? And you're like, you're right. And then you spend the rest of the day thinking about them, right? And you can't seem to let it go, and it still has some measure of control. You shift your behavior to try and come against them or prove them wrong or do, it's weird how they have had this influence on you. And you would like to think, I'm impervious to kind of their opinions of me, but that's just not how humanity works. That's not what it means to be human. And so if we're not careful, this can get out of hand. But this has just been true just from track record for all of us. If we're not careful, the mean people in our lives gain a measure of control over our lives. And here's what's also true. Mean people, they keep us off balance. We go through life and we're just kind of like when we experience their kind of animosity towards us, and we are hurt by them. When we're hurt by them, what we do is we react and we nurture the, and we kind of like live our life a little bit off balance. If you've ever been sort of off balance, the slightest nudge can cause lots of problems in your area. And so when we're around them, we are easily flustered. It's like little things, and it's not even just them anymore. It's little things from anybody that all of a sudden rile us up, and we think to ourselves, "Why am I so mad? All they did was." But the reason is probably because you're surrounded and you're experiencing mean people who keep us off balance. And then when we're off balance, we overcompensate, right? And if you've ever had an injury and you're like, you go to the doctor and you're like, my back hurts. And they're like, and you're like, it's something with my back. And they're like, actually, it's your hamstring that's affected to your calf, which has affected your foot. You got the wrong shoes. And you're like, no, my back hurts. And like, I know, but you're overcompensating in so many different areas that it's affecting other spots. So what happens is in our relationships, we get off balance with mean people. We refuse to let them go. And then we take it out on people we love who have nothing to do with the situation. And we go, what is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? What is wrong with me in this way? It often causes injury elsewhere in other relationships. So it gets us to this spot where we realize, man, I'm struggling with something. I have something, and even if I've kept it buried for a while, there are things that rile it up, that get it going, and there are certain situations. There are certain things that are said that seem innocuous and innocent at first, but then it does something in me, and I can't realize it. So here's a great like third or fourth date question. Not a great first or second date if you're into that, if that's the season of life that you're in, but a good third and fourth, just to try and find some common ground, is simply this: who hurt you? Who's hurt you? Now, you have to be very careful the tone in which you ask this question. But if you're like, I'm trying to get conversation going, aside from just the weather and how much the Mariners suck, we go, what else can I talk about? And if you start here, not if you start here, don't start here. Take that back. If eventually somehow over the course of the dinner or conversation or date or movie or whatever, you get to this spot, I promise you, there'll be so much runway to work with. So much runway to work with. And if you can be a trusted resource in helping people figure this out, man, that is a big deal on this. So this series is simply a question of who hurt you. And I want to do it in a positive way. And I want to talk about it in a way that I think, that the way of Jesus, because this is what we are. We're simply a church community. A church, what is a church? A church is an interpretive community about what the Bible has to say about Jesus' way of doing life. And it's been interpreted throughout centuries at different scenarios and different situations. And now in 2024, here we are. We're in the Tri-Cities. We're in like this mid-size, and I say mid-size in a positive way. We're probably small. Anyways, this small town with one Costco, this small town way of doing life where you kind of know people, you kind of don't. We're trying to make this, we're trying to figure out careers, we're trying to raise kids, we're trying to manage soccer schedules and volleyball schedules and all the things. And when it comes to dealing with our hurt, what does Jesus' way of doing life have to inform us with this? So again, that's where we're headed 2 weeks. I want to talk about specifically just for a minute, just to kind of, you know, humanize this. I think sometimes people in my position, where I have the microphone and this is like a one-way monologue sort of thing, can come up and be like, here's what y'all should do with all your problems, right? And you'd be like, well, you know, you don't know my problems and I don't know. There's just that different thing. Sometimes it's helpful for you to hear I have problems too. And so I want to illustrate one of those for you, if that's okay. Is that all right? About who hurt me. This is fun. Buckle up. This is a little counseling session you didn't know you signed up for. All right. Back in 2004, I graduated from college. My wife and I were not married yet. We were dating, and that was like in the future, and I think maybe we were even potentially engaged at that point. But 2004, I moved back from Seattle, going to do my undergraduate over there, and I began to work for my dad as a youth pastor at his church in Pasco. And an opportunity came up. I moved home and like didn't have a spot yet, and we were trying to figure out like renting and buying, doing this sort of thing. I ended up having an opportunity to buy a rental unit, because I'd played this Rich Dad Poor Dad game once as a board game thing, and Robert Kiyosaki, if you remember that. I just remember like how to win the game was always buy a rental. That was just the key to winning the game. And so I was like, maybe that translates to life too. So I bought a fourplex in Kennewick in 2004. I did this thing called, it was an 80-20 loan because I had no money. I put 0% down and my annual salary was $28,000 a year. But lucky for me, the bank was running a promo and a special, and the special was Fog a Mirror, get a loan. It was a really cool opportunity to get a loan when you're 21 years old, making $28,000 a year. And unfortunately, they don't actually offer those anymore. So if you're 21, you're like, how did you get that? They don't do that anymore. Because apparently it turned out to be a long-term bad strategy, as 2006 kind of showed us that doesn't work out too well for most people. But in my mind, it was like, this is brilliant. I live in one unit, I rent out the other three, it pays the mortgage, and I get to live for free and then, you know, cash in on some equity and do whatever. And for those of you in real estate, you know, like the number one rule of real estate. I mean, dude, you don't have to be in real estate to know this. What's the number one rule in real estate? Oh, maybe you don't know. Location, guys. Location. Again, we live in a small enough town. You're like, everything's close here. All right. Imagine you're in a big city. Location. That's the big thing, the big idea. And so when it comes to location with the fourplex that I purchased, if you had had a heat map of all of the police activity in the Tri-Cities, this would be a deep amber, like the reddest of reds, okay? My wife has an uncle who at that time was serving as an undercover Metro drug cartel, worked for the police department, but was like a secret drug dealer, but he was really for the good guys. And when at a dinner thing, we were talking about updating each other on life, and I was asking him how his job was, crazy good. And he goes, I heard you bought a fourplex. And I said, yeah. And I said, yeah, it's over on such and such street. And he goes, oh, I'm familiar with that street. Should have been like a red flag. Where were you a month before I bought this? All of those things. And interesting, when you have a location like that, there's a couple of predicaments that you don't think of, because how do you recruit people to then fill the three units that are around you to find renters in this area? Because for sure, based on the heat map activity, I didn't want to put a sign in the yard. Because who's attracted to that? People who are driving down that street, and what are they doing? Does that make sense? Are we connecting the dots here? All right, I'm trying to speak in coded language a little bit, but there was no Facebook Marketplace. Craigslist was not a thing. I took an ad out in the Tri-City Herald. I paid for ads in the Tri-City Herald, and then when that didn't work, I did the little nickel. You remember that thing? That's how I was recruiting people to come, because I tapped all of my personal resources of all of my friends who were broke and needed a place to live. And once I filled that one unit, then I had to fill the other two with all of these things. So I took ads out in the paper, and then I got married to Kylie in 2005. So we lived there for a while, it was interesting for that for a while. And then I remember we found out we were pregnant with London. And I think my uncle came to us, or her uncle came to us and was like, you cannot raise a child in this neighborhood. You need to find something different, right? And I was like, it was starting to make sense. I was starting to put the pieces together, because the couple who lived above us, like one of them is currently serving a life sentence for murder, and I'm not making that up. And I went and knocked on their door to tell them to turn the music down at 2 a.m. So that's what's happening with. Now, ironically, they were pretty good renters, to be honest with you. Other than the music at 2 a.m., they were always on time with rent, and it was always cash. I don't know what that means, but they weren't even close to the worst ones, guys. And since then, we bought another fourplex thing. We had a couple rentals. We eventually sold that one, but we've always had something like this going on. And I've probably rented, Kylie and I were talking about this yesterday, we've probably rented to over 40 different people, or you know, family units in 19 years. And even though, you know, that story of those people was bad, that was much after we had kind of met them. We've only had really like two awful experiences. One is too recent to talk about, so I don't want to talk about that one. The other one was a kid named Casey. So I want to tell you about, when you ask me who hurt me, Casey hurt me, okay? And Casey was a young single guy who heard through a mutual friend that we had an available unit. And so I got a phone call one day, unknown number. I answered, hey, I heard you had a spot. Yeah, absolutely. I'm like, this is great. He seemed very personable. We met. He had a job. He was also getting started with something called MMA, which I had no idea of at the time. He's like, I'm like this MMA guy. I'm like, oh, cool. I don't know what that means. Is that like a culinary thing? What is this? And he's like, because UFC, this is again, 2005, this was pre-UFC, this is all that kind of stuff. And so I had no idea about this. It was just him. He had no roommates, no pets, no rental history, but he was young. So, you know, can't fault the guy for that. He felt cool. You know what I mean? Like, you ever seen people that are like, oh, he seems cooler than me. Like, I think at the lunch table at high school, we'd be sitting at different tables probably. And so I was like, let's do this thing. And for 6 months, no issues whatsoever. Like on time, seemed great. I'd go over, everything looked great. And some of you guys have rentals and you're nodding along with me and it's just, you're just reliving this pain. 6 months, you're like, this is perfect. This is awesome. And then I got a call or a text message one day and it was just simply this. So I got a dog. And he wasn't asking. He wasn't inquiring about the pet policy. Just, I got a dog. And I didn't know how to respond to that because I'm young and whatever. And I was like, okay, interesting. And then another text message like a couple weeks later, which was simply, rent is going to be late this month. Not, is it okay that rent is going to be late this month? Not, I think, you know, I'm working on it or whatever. It was just simply a fact of what it is. It turns out that being in MMA means injuries that keep you from being able to work and pay rent. That was the bummer of it, was at that time you weren't getting paid very much to participate. And it hurt your abilities to kind of make rent the other way. He very quickly showed me that he was participating in what I like to call the pit bull approach to life. And what I mean by pit bull approach to life, I mean the singer who sang the famous song, I knew my rent was going to be late about a week ago, and you know, I'm still in this club getting it on, whatever. Anyways, and so I was like, oh, things have quickly changed in this way. Pitbull, ironically, the breed of the dog that he also got that didn't tell me about what he was doing. So not to stereotype or whatever. When I went to inquire about, these things are starting to stack up, right? Like I got a dog, rent's gonna be late, you know, all this kind of whatever. I went to inquire in person. I noticed that he had decided to decorate the ceiling with bottle caps from like his beers that he just popped everywhere. And it was really impressed with the quantity of how much real estate had taken up. It looked like this was a pattern of life that was going to be also impressive. His bulking physique. MMA, apparently, you get very, very fit. It was almost as if his shoulders swelled in proportion to his outstanding balance with us, is basically what it looked like for us. And my wife is, we're having a child. We're now living in West Richland, and we're broke, and rent's going to be, you know, it's going to be late and all this kind of stuff. And she's like, go tell him he can't do this to us. And I'm like, yeah, you should definitely stop by and tell him. Pregnant wife sending her awful. And I was like, you know what? I think I'm just going to text him that because that sounds like a better approach, less confrontational, whatever. 3 months go by. So now we're 9 months into this or so. Multiple, I'll have it by the fifths, right? Famous, like, I'll have it by the fifth. That's always the thing. And it just became, like, obviously way out of hand. And it's even worse than even I remember. Because yesterday, Kylie was like, what are you talking about? We always do this on the drive while we're driving or doing something like that. And I said, I'm going to talk about a little bit about Casey and getting hurt and the renter. You remember Casey? And she's like, oh, absolutely. And she said, are you going to talk about that police report received in the mail? About how someone, they had to show up because someone got shot with a bow and arrow inside the unit. And I was like, I totally forgot about that. As if that's something you could like completely forget about. You know what I mean? Like that feels like something that would stand out unless you've rented to Casey. And then that's just another thing to add to the mix of all of this. Eventually got to the spot where I'm like, all right, man, hey, man, hate to break this to you, but things aren't working out, right? And you probably need to leave. And he's like, yeah, no, it was, I mean, several months behind at rent at this point. It wasn't happening. It wasn't happening, you know, the ceiling, the dog, all the things, not working out. Okay, I'll be out on the fifth. I'll be out on the fifth. Great. On the sixth, I show up and his stuff's still there. I have like all my tools just because I'm like, you know, getting ready to go in and take some bottle caps off the ceiling and whatever. And he's like, I didn't specify which month. And I was like, oh gosh. And That's when it started getting downhill from there. And I won't even go into kind of how bad it got on there, but that's the spot where Kylie and I would spend evenings dreaming up creative ways to get Casey out of there. And I was getting very creative on my thoughts on that. And I remember you're just so angry, right? Like some, and you're just, how could they do this? Look, my wife is 7 months pregnant with our first child. Like we've gone all out for you. We've done all kinds of things. We've been over backwards for this kid to give him a chance to do this. Like how can you not take one act of kindness and then you know respond negatively, and then I do it again and just respond negatively again and respond. I just remember being like I'm so angry, and I remember we'd sit on the couch and it would like I said, they can have control over your life. There was not a minute that would go by that I'm not thinking about what legal options that I have. Who do I need to talk to? I'm writing fake letters about from lawyers, like you have to get out, eviction coming, all this kind of stuff. Like it was bad, guys. I was just hurt personally. We didn't have any margin. I was making again $28,000 a year. That there's no margin even on a fog of mirror get a loan sort of plan. You know what I mean? And I'm bitter. My wife's mad at him and probably slightly mad at me and rightfully so. And it was just a tough deal. And I remember just going into a very dark place with my relationship with Casey and what I was like thinking about. In the meantime, I'm a youth pastor at a church, standing up in front of a bunch of high school students, telling them about Jesus teaching about the way of the golden rule, right? Like, guys, do unto others as you want them to do unto you, and how Jesus' golden rule is like this evolutionary way of moving forward. The entire world had been like, treat others the way that they've treated you, right? Or treat others in a way that they deserve and whatever. And then Jesus comes on the scene and tells his disciples, nah, it's gonna be different than that. You're gonna treat people the way that you want to be treated. And I'm sitting there going on Wednesday nights, telling these youth kids, treat other people the way you want to be. And then on Wednesday night, I'm going home being like, man, freaking Casey, man. What do we got to do to get this guy out of there? And I'm so mad at what I want to do. And I remember looking at her and probably her having more of a standard than me, going like, who are we? Who are we to be thinking like this? How are we letting something like this affect us in this way? Who are we? What have we allowed ourselves to become? Because like it could be like, who has he made us? But also there's like a personal responsibility of what have we allowed ourselves to become? And maybe again, you have your own version of a Casey story. You have your own thing of somebody hurt you and you begin to think about, you know, things and you viewed them in a different light. You begin to view your outlook on life in a different light, your opportunities for growth and what, you know, your goals and your future. It's a failed marriage. It's a failed relationship. It's a business decision. It's a backstabbing. It's a betrayal. It's a something. And you found yourself in a very dark spot and you're not having problems navigating hurt. And you find yourself going, who am I? What have I allowed myself to become? Because that's what hurt can do to us if we're not careful. Hurtful people knock us off balance. We live off balance. We overcompensate. And we can allow them to control further and deeper than we wanted to be. And what happens too is we find ourselves so despising them and their activity and being able to like not think genuinely about any sort of thing that they do. Everything that they do is always bad. There's always a bad motive. There's always something dark. There's always something. And we do that. And we think to ourselves, we're starting to become exactly like them. I don't know who that blank is for you, but if you've been hurt by somebody, you've allowed them control and you've not navigated this properly, you can go, I'm becoming like them. I'm obsessed with getting even. And why in the world would I want to be even with somebody like that? And I obsess over getting even with them. We find ourselves becoming exactly like them. And Jesus offering us, and we read in the Gospels, this idea of do unto others, do unto others. And we translate it as this, do unto others as they've done unto me. Yeah, I will do unto others exactly the way that we've done unto us. Getting even makes us even with someone we don't even like. And that's a problem. When we're obsessed with getting even, when our only tool in our toolkit when it comes to dealing with hurt is getting even, then we just become like the person that we don't even like. And that's not the right answer, and we know that. It's better then to perhaps go, okay, is there an alternative? Is there a different way of doing this? Is there a way of getting beyond even? Ignoring it isn't it. Ignoring people's hurt in our life and their activity with us, that's not it. Getting even isn't it, but perhaps there's a third option, an option that guards and protects our heart and diminishes their power over us. Now, I talk about this and say we do this in the way of of Jesus. And we say, you know, every week our goal is to get together and be like, what is the way that that looks like? And that can oftentimes lean towards the New Testament because that's where we find stories about Jesus and his teachings and the way that he managed relationships. But today, I want to talk about a story from the Old Testament that shows up that I think is powerful in shaping the background of what Jesus is trying to teach, because I think a lot of times the Old Testament serves as a, here's what the, if you took the way of the world and just kind of worked on it, here's why this doesn't work. Let's talk about why it doesn't work, so then we can go with what works. And the same way that you're trying to, you know, when you teach your kids sometimes, you allow them to do something wrong so that you can show them, see, that's not the right answer. Let's look at the right answer then. And I think a lot of times when we see examples of this show up, so that's what we're gonna look at today, an example of how it doesn't work out. It's a story that involves a guy that we're somewhat familiar with, a guy named King David, who many of us, if you grew up in church, you know about King David. But the story that shows up that we're looking at isn't about him as a king. That would come later. We're looking at a story that involves him as a fugitive. So King David, also known in this story, relative to us, as Fugitive David. The story shows up in the book of Samuel. There's two sections to Samuel, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. The author was most likely, or the biographer was most likely Samuel or someone like him who was a prophet at that time, writing about the narrative between the handoff of King Saul into King David, a transition of two different kings, Saul being the first king of Israel, David being perhaps one of the more famous ones of this. Saul, when Israel says, we want a king, we want to be like all these other nations and have someone to look for and someone to be in charge, is identified as the king, and yet he's in a difficult position because he knows that he has not followed in line with what God has wanted from him. There's obviously some things about when you get power, it does something to you, it changes your behavior, changes your thinking, it changes your reliance on a grace that is beyond you, and you find yourself going, look at all of the things that I've done, look at all the things that I've created. And that sort of ego can drive people to be, can drive us into situations where we find God sort of pulling back some things and being like, well, let's see how you handle it without my blessing on some things, right? And so anyways, he's in this spot, and David's an up and coming guy, right? This is post Goliath, so he's already been a shepherd who has killed one of these famous warriors. He got a sword as a result of this. People are starting to sing in the streets. Yes, Saul's killed his thousands of men, but David's killed his tens of thousands. In other words, now there even the people are starting to, some of them come behind David as the obvious successor to the kingship after Saul is gone. Now, the hard part of that is if you've ever been in a situation at your work where somebody who's currently in power has already been challenged by the person who's up and coming, like when that has been established, that is a difficult spot to be in, right? In terms of churches, this is the world that I live in. Once a pastor has said, this is so-and-so, they're on staff, they're gonna be taking over the church after me, it is a real tension-filled few years while they figure out the timeline of when this person exits and this person comes on and what the responsibilities are. And your workplace, you know this too. It's awkward, it's tough. Things are said, things are heard, and emotions are high and all of this. So that's what's happening in this story with this. In chapter 25, verse 2, we're gonna read a story here about David's interaction with somebody. Now, at this point, David has already been anointed by Samuel as the next king. But again, Saul knows this, there's animosity there. David is dwelling in the countryside as a fugitive because his life is in danger. Saul is thinking, if I kill him, then there's no way that he can possibly be king. Perhaps I'll hold on to it longer. So he's in kind of hiding in this way. A certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. Two things about this. Number one, the way to illustrate wealth in Old Testament times is very different from our times. Because I don't know, if I read this and I didn't really know church and whatever, and I was like, well, I don't really read a lot, but this is interesting. I don't know what I would do with 1,000 goats. That sounds like a headache more than a blessing. You know what I mean? So our translation for a modern day would be like, he had a garage full of cars, all right? And you've seen this, you'd be like, what do you do with all of these cars? Exactly. Who knows what they do with all the cars? But that's an illustration of wealth. And so he had a lot of cars. And this was sheep shearing day in Carmel. This was a harvest is when wealthy people figured out exactly how wealthy they were. A lot of times the sheep would be existing in the countryside. They'd be like, how many are there? I don't know. There's a lot of them. We can't really keep them all in. We don't even know how wealthy we are until everything comes in. And on that day, they figure out how rich I really am. It's a good day. I don't know what kind of line of work that you do. Perhaps your work is just, I get a paycheck every month. I know exactly what it is. But I would guess that there are some of you who are in sales or commission-based things where you're not exactly sure, or there's end-of-year bonuses where you're like, I don't know what I'm gonna make, but it's gonna be a good day when that email comes through. When I open up that envelope, when that hits the direct deposit, you feel rich, don't you? For like a day, or you feel at least not broke. Anyways, one of those things, you're in that spot. It's a good day. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent, beautiful woman, but her husband was harsh and mean in his dealings. And this is illustrated to us in a couple of different ways. One, in just the illustration of the word harsh, but then also Nabal literally means mean. that's the name of his meaning, or hard, like a hard individual. And so you've got this contrasting, and you've seen this in marriages too. Like one person is on one side of the spectrum and one is on the other. This is what we get in this relationship. While David was in the wilderness, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. This rich guy is about to get richer, and it's public knowledge because all the sheep are kind of coming in and the word's going around. So he sent 10 men, young men, and said to them, go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name and say to him, long life to you, good health to you and all of your household, and good health to all that is yours. This is a formal ancient greeting. Basically, I come in peace and congrats to you, blessings unto you, to whatever, right? When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them. And the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing or went missing. Meaning, we spent some time with them. And not only did we not abuse them or demand some things from them, but also there was a level of protection that was offered to them by us based on other rogue mercenaries. There's an assumed breakage rate of any sort of business venture that you do, right? If you're a waiter at a restaurant, there's an assumed breakage rate of every once in a while you drop glasses and they don't take it out of your salary. They go, we just assume we're gonna break a few glasses. Now, break too many glasses, you get fired. That's how that works. But in every business, in every line of business, there's some sort of we could capitalize on it, but we're just gonna assume that that's just gonna be a loss. David's saying, when they were with us, you experienced no loss. There was no breakage. Like there was something about you profited from our presence there. Even though we didn't work for you, even though there wasn't a formal agreement, like we said, we'll provide protection if you give us so much money or whatever. We didn't have any sort of contract in place. But like, there's no question that you are gonna have a bumper crop of sheep shearing, that this is gonna be a good year for you. And part of that is due to our interactions and our abilities to be able to kind of work with you on this. Ask your servants and they'll tell you, therefore be favorable toward my men since we come at a festive time. This is him saying in this, you know, we know that this is a good time for you. We know that you're about to get richer. And we know that during this time, you're more apt to give towards charity than in any other time of the year, which is why there's no red kettlebells outside of Walmart in July. You know what I mean? Like, we know how festive sort of charity stuff sort of works. Please give your servants and your son David, right? Like assuming I'm not telling you to do anything. I'm just asking for your charity. I'm asking you if it's within your heart to see that there were some side benefits for being around us, for our interactions and our relationship. That if you get richer in the process, perhaps you could see it amongst yourself to be able to provide for us who are living as fugitives, who don't have a lot to go off of, whatever you can find for them. It's a clear act or request for charity. When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name, and then they waited. And they waited, and they waited, and no response came to them. Now, here's a couple of things that we know about David. If you grew up in church and you went to like a kid's like Sunday school class like we have going on over there, right? And there's little crafts and little things. And anytime David's talked about, it's like, it's probably gonna be either the story of Goliath, right, or whatever, or it's gonna be him playing. He played an instrument, right? He played a harp or a lyre. He was like really good at this kind of stuff. He had other things in his life that was pretty dark and whatever. We don't usually have flannel graphs for those. But we leave those alone. But here's what we do know. Like he played. And if you play an instrument, a harp or a lyre, like that is feels very soft. Like that could be a, I don't know. I don't want to like pick on people who play woodwind instruments or whatever. But like if there's a big tough guy that came up to you and be like, and he's like, I want to play in your band. And we'd be like, oh great. Guitar, bass, drums. What do you play? Flute. I'd be like, oh, interesting. Okay. We could figure out a spot for you. And so two things can be true at the same time. One, David can be known to play a harp or a lyre. And then we also know that David was a very dangerous, violent man. Our stories show that he was a very complicated individual, that there was some sexual indiscretion also involved in his story, that he was both a man after God's own heart, but then also had a very, very dark side. There's like two sides to David in this way. Later on, this biographer would go on to kind of describe David's life in this way. Whenever David attacked an area, he did not leave a man or woman alive, but took sheep and cattle, donkeys and camels and clothes. I mean, he killed everybody. He had like some, at some point, no morals, and then he would play his harp. And you're like, who is this person? And he would dance naked before the Lord. Like, what is going on with David's life exactly? Probably not someone that you wanted to get on the bad side of. Probably someone who's not thrilled at waiting for an answer to a request from charity after we would both agree that there was mutual benefit for us. And if you're winning, how about you share a little bit of that winning with us? Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse?" Not because he didn't know who David was. He obviously did. He said, "Who is this son of Jesse?" It's like he already knows the family history of this. The response is more on the lines of, "Who does he think he is?" Not, "Who is he in general? I need more information about this person." Who does he think he is? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. He's doing this dig at this person. "You're just one of many. You're just a peon. There are so many people like you. You rebel from your master. You're nothing to me. I didn't ask for your help, and I don't need your help, and I am not sharing anything with him." He goes on, "Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to men coming from who knows where?" David's men turned around and went back, and when they arrived, they reported every word. And David said to them, "Oh, well, it was worth a try." No, man, you should read your Bibles more. I'm telling you guys, it's really, really good. If you think that that's how it ended, that's harp David responding. You know what I mean? That's liar David. David said to his men, "Each of you, strap on your sword. Strap on your sword." This is when it starts to get violent. "And then he said to his men, 'Each of you strap on his sword.' So they did, and David strapped on his as well." And I think this is important. The biographer's making a point that David strapped on his sword. Because I gave it away a little bit earlier, but do you remember where David got his sword? He kills Goliath with a slingshot as a kid. And what's his prize? Yeah, the head of Goliath, but also Goliath's sword, a symbol for him of God's provision and protection when he didn't deserve it. A symbol of forever of God's on my side. I did nothing to deserve that. I mean, like, a kid with a slingshot going up against a giant man with a sword, the odds are stacked greatly against you. Nearly impossible. God showing up in impossible situations. God's provision. And the sword, every time he would look at it, would be a visual reminder, like, I can't, but God can. And yet in this situation, what does he do? He leverages that symbol and instead attempts to take control of his own situation for this. It's a visual aid of God's promise and his protection. But David is hurt and he's off balance. And he's hearing messages of people saying, "Who even is David? Who does he think he is?" I've heard of a lot of people struggling with this. He's forgotten the story that came along with the sword. And verse 13 says this, "About 400 men went up with David." David strapped on his sword and took up 400 men. 200 men stayed back with supplies. David took 2/3 of his army over to fight one rich dude shearing sheep. That is an overreaction of proportionate, like it's beyond, of epic proportion. And David, the biographer, invites us into this mental state of David. He's building up a case for himself to do something he knows he probably shouldn't be doing. Have you ever done anything like that? I know I shouldn't be doing this, but let me build my case. Let me convince myself that I should. Let me have imaginary conversations with people. I've been hurt, so I bulk up. I get 2/3 of my army. I break out all this provision. I begin to do what I can to take control. And have you ever noticed how people in imaginary conversations that you're having with always act correctly? They side with you. They're like, no, you present unassailable logic in this situation. I clearly see I was in the wrong. I am so sorry, Mom. Let me clean my room. You are right. Oh, absolutely. Take my phone away. I do not need this distraction in my life in this season. That never happens. They never see things the way they see. We are like, they're always contrite. They're always apologetic. They're demonstrably regretful for their behavior. That's never true. Never happens, right? But in our minds, we do this. David's doing this exactly. Verse 21, David had just said, it's been useless. All my watching over this fellow's property in the wilderness so that nothing of his was missing. And there's no way that he actually, there's no way that he initially thought, I'm gonna protect this guy's stuff. I think probably what happened is he's out there, he's doing his own thing. And all of a sudden they're kind of alongside of it. It was not his intention to do this. He was not looking out for Nabal's people. He didn't care, but there is an idea that Nabal's guys did benefit from it. But he's creating this thing of, I did this. I thought through this. I offered protection. He's like, no, you didn't. You did not. He has paid me back evil for good. And may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him. Again, harp and lyre David going, I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill the people who work for him. I'm going to kill his sons. I'm going to kill everything. Because we overreact. Because we're hurt. And hurt people. Hurt people. After all the things that I've done for him. We're going to pause the story there. We're going to finish this next week. There's two characters so far. There's two different responses, and there's zero heroes in our story. Like, who's the guy that we're cheering for here? There's no right answer, right? Nabal has repaid evil for good. You offered supposedly good, and I'm paying you with evil, and then David responds with evil for evil. Nabal is maniacal, but David's predictable. David's done what we've all done. What it means to be human, we get hurt, we respond, we're off balance, we harbor things, we build up cases in our mind of how terrible they are, how right we would be, how justified we would be in doing our actions. And even they would know in the situations that we play it out in our minds. And yet, it never seems to work out that way. So what do we do with that? And with that, I want to leave it. And I want you to come back next week as we go, what do we do with that? But I'm not gonna leave you empty-handed completely. Here's a couple of questions to consider and ponder. As you found yourself in that story, in your own version of this, and I'm becoming like the person that hurt me, and I don't like that in any way. This idea, four questions to think about regarding people who are difficult to deal with. Number one, do you even want to be even with someone you don't even like? We're obsessed with getting even. Why would you want to be even with somebody you don't even like? That's the first question. Number two, wouldn't you rather be ahead? Wouldn't you rather be ahead of that? Wouldn't you rather go beyond that? Wouldn't you rather get beyond getting even? Number three, when this is nothing more than a story you'll tell on a Sunday morning about a renter who screwed you, what kind of a story do you want to tell? When this thing that you're going through, when this hurt, and I know it feels, when you're hurting, when you're experiencing pain, there's no escaping it. It becomes the dominant thing that you think of. And it's like everything just kind of fades out and it just becomes all present and everything's about it and you can't sleep and it's affecting how you eat and it's affecting, I get it. I understand that. And I know psychologically how that works, but when this is, just for a moment, if we could just pause and just take one step back, when this is just a story that you'll tell someday, what kind of a story do you want this to be about you? And finally, what would it look like to return good for evil? We know what it looks like to return evil for good. Somebody does good things to you, you've done good things for them, they return it with evil. You know, definitely know what it's like to return evil for evil. Somebody does evil things to you, you get back and then do unto others as they have done unto you. We know exactly how that works. But what would it look like? And you don't even have to do it this week. I'm not saying come back next Sunday and we'll share stories about how it worked out for you and we'll have four people up here and you'll be sitting there being like, I'm awful because I didn't do any of this stuff. You know what I mean? I'm not gonna do that. No testimonies, no stories, no videos, no nothing. I'm just saying, what if you thought about, what if you paused and thought about it, what it might look like to return good for evil in this, to take Jesus seriously. And he said, I want you to do good for those who've done evil to you. I want you to return. I want you to return good on the evil that has been done to you, to do good to those who mistreat you. No doubt, one of the hardest instructives of Jesus. In fact, if I was to just start there and be like, this is what we're going to talk about, there would be almost like a disconnect between how I live my life and what you're asking me to do, Jesus, because we identify so much more with David and Nabal's story. Like we see ourselves in that story. And there's going to be some resolution there. We'll get to that in a week or so. But for now, remarkable begins with an answer to this question right here. And if I leave you with nothing today, I just want you to know this is the takeaway point for today. You don't pull ahead by attempting to get even. It's far better to think about what would it take to get beyond even. So I'm going to leave that with you. We're going to pray. All of these questions, by the way, if you were trying to write them down, couldn't get them down fast enough, on our app is a little notes page. Those are all on there. You can follow along with that. But let's pray. Father, thank you for stories that take us out of the theory of this, because we know the principles to be true, but when we hear stories, both, you know, personal stories that I share, but then also just this biblical story, we see a little bit of ourselves in that. We begin to kind of attach values to things that are a little bit distanced from our, because we're so hurt, we can't really see too closely in our situation about what we ought to do, but it's easy for us to kind of direct traffic when we're outside of it. And I pray that through this process that we would realize, yeah, you know what? Why would I want to get even? I don't want to get even. I want to get beyond that. I don't want to be hurt by this anymore. I don't want to get walked on. I don't want to deal with this. But God, help me to see what it would look like to return evil with good, and or to return good over evil. How do I respond in this way? How do I do good for those who often are aggressively mistreating me? What does that mean for me? And I pray that this week, whatever it is, whatever that situation is, whatever our blank is when it comes to filling in the blank, as we kind of go specific in our own interpretation of this, may we operate with wisdom on what this might look like in our life to encourage you to do something about it. In your name, amen. Thanks again for listening. If you've got more questions about the church or community group options for connecting with East Lakers outside of Sunday mornings, I'd encourage you to check out our website, eastlaketricities.com, or better yet, download our app by searching East Lake Tri-Cities in your favorite app store.